Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Dr. Nikki Williams makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute, and it's great to see you out here on this rather cold and a little bit wet Sydney night. I'll introduce our speaker very briefly. Dr. Williams has had a career in resources, among other places. She's worked for Shell and Exxon. She's also been involved in policy advocacy in a number of areas, most recently for about a decade with the New South Wales Minerals Council, and in recent times with the Coal Association. She's a graduate from the UNSW, and tonight Nikki Williams is going to talk to us on the topic of politics and the Australian coal industry. What's next? Dr. Williams, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Gerard. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's great to see you here, and I thank you for making the effort in, as Gerard said, rather inclement weather. Now, ABC journalist Quentin Dempster once commented that Australia grew up on the coal conveyor belt, not the sheep's back. And perhaps it's ironic that in Australia, the coal industry confronts the type of opposition and protest which you see on the screen before you each and every day. At mine sites, ship loaders, railway tracks, at AGMs, in the media, in local towns and major urban centres, on roadways, in advertisements in national and international newspapers, in petitions to government, in apparently academic treatises, and right across social media platforms. There are literally thousands of expressions of anti-coal sentiment popping up every day of every week, of every month, of every year. So how to know what's real and what isn't? What's justified criticism requiring an adequate industry response? And what's fiction? Is all the noise a groundswell of popular hatred or a concerted effort to amplify the voice of a relative minority? On the 8th of April, the Sydney Morning Herald reported Bill McKibben of 350.org out of the USA as saying that Australian coal mining has become a rogue industry. Now, this sinful image is widely promoted by the self-styled planetary saints, and the authors of such views are rarely seriously questioned about how they arrived at the view or whether the facts upon which they rely are really facts at all. Now, 12 hours after Mr. McKibben's comments were reported, ABC TV referred to North Korea as a rogue state. And that made me think, is it possible that the Australian coal industry really bears any comparison to a demented autocracy that is threatening the world with nuclear war? Surely the answer's no, but it's clear that Mr. McKibben's worldview, with its very halo-like characteristics of zeal and authenticity, has gained credence in the public domain. And this has in turn profoundly influenced the policy sphere. So I want to suggest tonight that there's a very big difference between protesting for what you value and fundamentalist eco-activism. The war against coal and fossil fuels in the name of climate should be exposed, should really be exposed for what it is, an attempt to snooker development by stealth. It's often an affront to democratic values whilst posing as legitimate people power. Anti-development activists are attempting to bludgeon society with a singular value set that has the capacity to transform our world in ways that most of us would not endorse. There is a more fundamental debate than climate versus coal. It speaks to the burning issue of energy poverty and the way our society deals with volatility and tension, with accommodations that breed the expectation of further accommodation, with paradoxes, with a quantum of information that can obscure as much as enlighten. With the growth in the number of constituencies, which makes it harder to achieve consensus. I question the merit of a society which seems more concerned with causes than with service, with endless concessions to the loudest voice, rather than a focus on divining and delivering against a series of overarching national interests. And I do question the motives of people and of movements whose objectives are not aligned with the broader interests of the society in which we live. Now, Mr. McKibben stated in Rolling Stone magazine recently, and I quote him, "After decades of scant organised response to climate change, a powerful movement is quickly emerging around the world, building on the work of scattered frontline organisers who've been fighting the fossil fuel industry for decades. It has no charismatic leader and no central organisation. It battles on 1,000 fronts." He describes this as the fossil fuel resistance and encourages people, and I quote, "to change the system that's raising the temperature, the sea level and the extinction rate." He says that for developed countries, small shifts in lifestyle won't be enough. He claims that the climate fighters are an economic resistance movement that's aware that renewable energy creates 3 times as many jobs as coal and gas and oil, and that they're good jobs that can't be outsourced. Now, these are mere assertions lacking any evidentiary basis, but such claims are mostly lapped up as gospel, the usually unquestioned acceptance of any manner of assertions by anti-coal activists means that a highly regulated and, of course, legal sector like the coal industry must constantly refute mistruths and endlessly defend its incumbency as the world's second largest source of primary energy. Now, to date, the coal industry has looked more like a conventional army, playing and fighting by certain established rules against detractors whose tactics more closely parallel or mirror the hit and run of guerrilla insurgencies. And of course, that is an inside-out perspective, an industry view, and there are many who would not agree, or would scoff, I should say, at that comparison. However, the eco-activists are experienced, they're professional, they're well-resourced and they're highly motivated campaigners. They're driven by an anti-development ideology rather than by a mission to improve coal industry practice. The eco-warriors are not trying to force the coal industry to be more responsive to environmental or social values. On the contrary, their focus is to put the coal industry out of business. And in doing that, they jeopardise much more than the commercial interests of coal companies. The eco-warriors present and presumably see themselves as the defenders of the commonwealth and of collective values. They portray the coal industry, of course, as a scion of private wealth, a crucible of greed and selfish individualism. The activist prism is cast in such a way as to appear democratic and embracing, painting coal as autocratic and self-interested. Now, naturally, it won't surprise you to know, I reject such characterisations. But the question is, has ideology derailed the energy climate debate? Are other agendas at play? Is Australia on an unwitting slippery slope towards the strangulation of the coal industry and all its related rail, road and port infrastructure and diverse supporting services, with all that that implies for jobs, investment and prosperity? There are many decent, concerned citizens who applaud the work of the anti-coal ideologues and many individuals, charitable trusts and corporate donors which finance it. But how has it come to be that the creators of prosperity, the company which produces the coal that electrifies 75% of Australia and 90% of New South Wales, the companies which have made coal Australia's second largest export earner after iron ore, the companies which have invested $125 billion in Australia and paid $210 billion in royalties and taxes over the last decade, and the companies which employ directly and indirectly almost 250,000 Australians, how is it that they are being so successfully demonised by activists? Why did the energy and climate change policy debate spawn a new morality of industrial sabotage, where extremism is hiding behind apparently laudable green goals? Do Australians and the lawmakers who represent us actually understand what's going on. Now, if you listen to the debate, Australia, as the world's largest exporter of a little over 300 million tonnes of coal, is involved in a criminal act of global proportions. Of course, our exports apparently will not only destroy the Great Barrier Reef, the burning of our coal accounts for 25% of the global carbon budget out to 2050, which means it must be stopped in its tracks to avert dangerous global warming. Now, these claims are just false. This critique ignores realities. The world is currently consuming 7 billion tonnes of coal each year, and half of that, more than half of that, is in China. China is installing the equivalent of Australia's entire electricity generating grid every 4 months. If we turned off the lights and left Australia for good tomorrow, the greenhouse gas emissions saved would be replaced within a few months. Now, let's be clear. Greenhouse gases from burning coal are a problem. The increase alone, not the actual total, just the increase in China's emissions last year of 820 million tonnes was equivalent to the total greenhouse gas emissions of Germany and Romania combined. I also don't suggest that because Australia is a relative coal minnow, that what we do is meaningless. I simply point out some obvious truths. Coal is being used and will continue to be used to drag hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. Stopping Australia's coal exports is a sham response, and perhaps even a shameful response, if you're really concerned about global warming. Because if we don't have a solution to coal use in China and India, we certainly do not have a solution to climate change. This incontrovertible fact is recognised by every major entity, including the World Bank, the International Energy Agency, and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. But the increasingly radicalised movement against coal and fossil fuels rejects carbon technologies like carbon capture and storage as PR, and argues for direct action and civil disobedience to guillotine the industry. Now, Ramsey Sprague, he's an activist in Texas, has said, "We see ourselves as people who are acting in an emergency capacity. This fight will be very intense and it will be very polarising." A recently retired hedge fund owner, Tom Steyer, who according to Forbes magazine has a net worth of $1.4 billion, has retired and decided to join the resistance movement. And his war cry is, and I quote, "The goal here is not to win. The goal here is to destroy these people." Now, I think that comments like that should concern us all. I view with interest the 30-year forestry battle in Tasmania. Despite a solution and funding having been agreed just a few weeks ago, seeking to balance jobs, investment and environment, involving hundreds of stakeholders, the National Greens Party and big chunks of the activist movement have rejected the agreed position and vowed to fight on. It's interesting and I think extremely worrying, because all societies, all processes and all negotiations have to have an end point. The difficulty is when the ideologically motivated don't like the end point, often despite having had a heavy involvement in shaping the process and participating in the negotiations, they simply reject the outcome and continue the war. Indeed, people like McKibben explicitly acknowledge this fact. He derides policy negotiations between government and stakeholders, including green NGOs, saying that, and I quote him, "Given the Arctic has already melted, we don't have room for easy compromises." Well, I don't know about you, but the last time I flew to Europe, which in fact was last week, the Arctic was still most definitely there. And I don't believe that most people want to live in a polarised, fractured world where only one problem, climate change, consumes the attention and energy of our institutions and the societies they serve. Ultimately, stakeholders with whom it is possible to discuss to find acceptable outcomes and solutions cannot be compared to stakeholders for whom any improvement, any change, any cost incurred to achieve better outcomes will simply never be enough. All the agonising twists and turns, all the time, all the energy, all the money, all the project delays, all the community uncertainty, all the meetings, the papers, the discussions and public briefings all amount to nothing if the stakeholder concerned is not actually motivated by any goal other than your extinction. I want to make very clear here that I do distinguish between extremist, ideologically driven anti-coal campaigning and the protest activities of citizens who live in mining regions and are affected by, or fear they may be affected by, coal developments. There is an enormous difference between local people seeking answers and reassurance or expressing opposition to a particular course of action by a coal company and the actions of political campaigners whose only objective, by whatever means and on the basis of whatever cause, is to extinguish the industry. There is also a fundamental difference in the nature of corporate responsibilities to those two very different classes of stakeholder, something I referred to earlier. Now, according to Philip Lawrence, where in 1990 there were some 400 international environmental NGOs, today there are approximately 1.4 million. Now, this is what Nick Cater has described as professional environmentalism, with the individuals and organisations being, and I quote him, the ambulance chasers of the biosphere, swarming around any new cause. Now, organisations famous for these tactics include household names like Greenpeace and GetUp, which depend largely on pioneering volunteers who claim environmentalism as their raison d'etre and the grounds of their moral superiority. As Cater says, whilst fighting causes is what they do for a quid, they still succeed in presenting as if they were on the side of the average citizen. They have mastered low-cost and no-cost advertising and the marketing techniques that new social media have spawned. And they have very successfully learned to manufacture compassion because, as we know, every good cause requires a victim with an unprotected plight. Law-breaking is deemed a badge of honour. Now, attitudes towards law-breaking are at best curious and at worst hypocritical. We live in a democracy and the right to free speech and to protest are essential to the maintenance of that democracy. That said, breaking the law is too often commended when that breach is committed by an activist, but rightly condemned and punished if committed by a corporate. Comparisons have been drawn between the heroics of individual activists like Jonathan Moylan, whose antics recently wiped nearly more than $300 million off the value of a coal company and saw many average investors lose money, with Gandhi, with Mandela, and even indeed with Jesus Christ. Now, with the greatest respect, and I mean that sincerely, to Mr. Moylan, can we really give credence to the idea promoted by Senators Milne and Rhiannon, Richard Dennis of the Australia Institute, and the former Senator Bob Brown, that Jonathan Moylan has what it takes to be the next global hero? So let's be blunt. Fraud is fraud. Criminal damage is just that. Stock market manipulation is illegal and prejudices everyone's savings through their superannuation or the direct investments they may have. Jeopardising one's own safety or imperilling the safety of others surely should not be tolerated. Apparently, however, for many people, and not just activists but observers as well, the end justifies the means. That's a philosophy which says, I agree with the cause, so I support the tactics. The problem is, civil society, a civilised society, can't function that way. Your terrorist is my freedom fighter. My sociopath is your eccentric friend. My love of music pelting full blast is your nightmare. It's a philosophy coolly and famously articulated by Machiavelli in Advice to the Medicis. It's a philosophy which I suspect many of the largest spy agencies around the world adhere to. And it is certainly the philosophy which guides the behaviour of ruthless governments of whatever nominal political or theological persuasion around the world. It is not a philosophy consistent with democracy. There is a double standard in operation, and whatever one's views about coal, at a conceptual level, most people would agree with the general principle that standards of accountability, transparency, respect for the law and truthfulness should apply equally to any and all individuals and corporates, whether they're NGOs or otherwise. The time has come for those that seek to occupy the moral high ground to square with the public about their motivations and objectives. Being honest about their vision and the contested nature of the facts on which they rely to support their vision would allow people to assess how desirable their vision of the future is and whether, now knowing the truth, the majority of Australians actually want to have a stake in such a future. For example, generating 100% of Australia's electricity affordably and immediately from renewables is a beautiful vision promulgated daily by the activists. The activist claims that it's simply vested interest that impedes such a world. A draft report on this subject by the Australian Energy Market Operator, commissioned by the government at the behest of the Greens Party, demolishes this claim. The fact that it would cost the equivalent of the federal government's total budget just to install such a system, the fact that it would require us to import the vast majority of componentry from China and elsewhere, the fact that it would require a landmass equivalent to approximately 3 Sydneys to be covered in solar arrays and wind turbines, the fact that most renewable capacity would have to be backed up by a similar installed capacity of coal and gas to cover intermittency, the fact that wind and sun power can't be stored, the fact that the wind and sun blow and shine without regard to where energy demand is geographically located, the fact that wholesale electricity prices would double, and we, being the Australian Coal Association, have estimated that retail prices would certainly rise even more, and the fact that there'd be no manufacturing jobs for Australians in such a transition, are inconvenient facts which the anti-development activists simply ignore, downplay or dissimulate. The Australian Energy Market Regulator was explicit that their report was neither a prediction nor an endorsement, and that the costs that they had come up with were likely to be significantly understated. Perhaps most ironically, ladies and gentlemen, none of those turbines or solar arrays can be built without coal. So every renewable icon is a standard bearer of embedded carbon. Squaring with the public would require the campaigners to admit that energy and climate change policy is intimately related to quality of life, employment and economics. It would require acknowledgement that this is a hugely complex set of issues not amenable to slogans and idealism. Campaigners would need to embrace pragmatism over ideology, imperfection over unreality, and solutions over defiance. They would need to accept certain truths even as they would wish them away, such as the inescapable reality of increasing coal use globally, or that renewables simply cannot meet, due both to cost and technical constraints, society's energy and climate change objectives single-handedly. But even if they could acknowledge these truths, I doubt that the fundamentalists would easily admit that what we're really debating is not good versus bad, clean versus dirty, high versus low, multinational versus local, big versus small, sustainable versus unsustainable. The core of the debate is fundamentally about development, how much or little, how fast or slow, if or when human needs take precedence over those of other living things, and whether the developing world has a right to aspire to and eventually obtain the quality of life enjoyed in the developed world or not. This is for the simple reason that the policies and technologies the anti-coal activists are pursuing ultimately have deep transformative effects which most people would not, I suspect, support. Paul Kelly said recently that fairness and equity go hand in hand with economic growth. But if the activist agenda were fully implemented in Australia, the consequences would be far-reaching for all citizens, constricting consumption, limiting population, depressing prosperity, and redefining what people should and can aspire to. The activists want to close down Australia's $60 billion coal industry, which steered our economy, or at least helped to steer our economy, through the global financial crisis. They ignore the fact that mineral resources account for the lion's share of Australia's natural and competitive advantage. They're uninterested in the fate of the 1.1 million Australians who work in energy-intensive manufacturing, a sector which has only been made possible because of its access to a competitively priced, reliable coal energy base. They give no thought to how Australia could affordably and reliably secure its energy needs if you eliminated fossil fuels from our generation mix. They give no thought to what it's like trying to run a household, raise a family, or look after one's ageing parents, whether it's uncertain whether and for how long on any given day there'll be an affordable power supply. The activists, supported by the Greens Party, seek to tax the industry to death in order to redistribute those funds to needy social and environmental causes, but neglect to acknowledge that you can't distribute, as Keith DeLacy recently said, what isn't being produced. Now, people are entitled to their worldviews and to promote them, providing, of course, they don't encourage violence, but, and it's a significant but, only if they're made explicit so that citizens are not being duped into supporting one cause when a hidden agenda is the real name of the game. My essential premise is that a life lived without energy is a life lived in poverty. According to the International Energy Agency, more than 40% of the world's energy comes from coal. Coal has met 45% of the increase in global demand for energy, more than all renewables, including hydro and nuclear, combined. The IEA projects that global electricity demand will increase 70% by 2035, and over half of that increase is in China and India alone. Indeed, in its 2012 World Energy Outlook, the International Energy Agency said that coal remains and will remain the backbone fuel for electricity generation globally. There is an explicit nexus between electrification and quality of life, but people simply don't associate a coal mine with the hot shower they take in the morning, the car they drive, their access to concrete and steel for home building or renovations, or refrigeration, cooking, clean water, a hot cup or a cool house, a warm office, their smartphone or their computer. Most Australians are unaware of the extent of global energy poverty. 1.3 billion people on the planet do not have access to a single electric light bulb, and 2.6 billion people still have to use dung and scavenged timber to heat or cook with. So electricity and nation-building products like steel and cement, all derived from coal, can and do transform people's lives. This reality has been brilliantly outlined by Matt Ridley, who has described a hypothetical family in the year 1800 eating gristly stew in front of a miserly wood fire, and I quote from him. Suppose you said to them that in two centuries their descendants would need to fetch no logs or water and carry out no sewage, because water, gas, and a magic form of invisible power called electricity would come into their home through pipes and wires. They would jump at the chance to have such a home, but they would warily ask how they could possibly afford it. Suppose that you told them that to earn such a home, they need only ensure that the mother and father both have to go to work for 8 hours a day in an office or factory, travelling roughly 40 minutes each way in a horseless carriage, and that the children need not go to work at all, but should go to school to be sure of getting such jobs when they started work at 20. They would be more than dumbfounded. They would be delirious with excitement. Where they would cry is the catch. Today, the average person on the planet consumes power at the rate of about 2,500 watts. That's about 600 calories per second. Now, about 85% of that comes from burning fossil fuels. Since a reasonably fit person on an exercise bike can generate around about 50 watts, this means that it would take about 150 slaves working 8 hour shifts each to peddle you to your current lifestyle. Now, interestingly, Americans would need 600 slaves, the French would need 360, and Nigerians a mere 16. So next time you lament human dependence on fossil fuels, pause to imagine that for every family of four that you see on the street, there should be 600 unpaid slaves back home living in abject poverty. The anti-coal movement has not originated, I believe, from spontaneous and evolving concern about the undeniable and sometimes very negative social and environmental impacts of what the coal industry does. The agenda to axe coal has its origins in the philosophy of deep ecology, and I encourage you to Google that term. Philosophically, deep ecology views humans as just one part of the biotic system, with a right to survive, but not to extract and modify natural resources for the betterment of humanity. For deep ecologists, humanity is of no more importance than an amoeba or smallpox virus, for example. They argue, and I quote here, human self-importance damages the environment and drastic action is required. They aim to achieve a fundamental ecological transformation of our socio-cultural system, collective actions and lifestyles. And when you hear people like the Swiss animal rights campaigner Antoine Duchel discuss the dignity of fish, which I did last couple of weekends ago on the ABC, I think you'd be pretty sure they're heavily influenced by the philosophy of deep ecology. Now, deep ecology, or deep ecologists like David Foreman, suggest that the entire biosphere is only sustainable if global population is reduced to 100 million people. I don't know what the other 6.9 billion people on the planet would think about that, but important to note that global population is increasing by 82 million people a year. Now, the Population Media Centre states that 95% of population growth is occurring in countries already struggling with poverty, illiteracy and civil unrest. And it states that our mortal footprint is killing the planet and that Earth is attempting to retemper the balance and check this population growth by unleashing widespread disease, food and water shortages and violent weather as a result of climate change. But where you are uncertain whether your children will survive and where the state doesn't support the elderly who can no longer work, reproduction is the only means to try to guarantee that there'll be family to sustain you in old age. The scale of infant mortality is directly associated with economic prosperity. The wealthier a nation, the better is the availability of healthcare and hygiene, the higher is the rate of infant survival, and the lower is the rate of population growth. In Africa, 51% of children die before the age of five. Electrification and the use of steel, cement and other nation-building materials to provide clean water, refrigeration, clean cooking, to run hospitals and medical equipment, etc., is the only way to lift people from this horrendous poverty. And Philip Lawrence says that a key driver to uncontrolled population growth is poverty. Poverty is also a well-researched influence on environmental degradation. And he says that it would seem a ridiculous strategy for big international NGOs to run campaigns that hold any nation in poverty. Sadly, these realities are mostly ignored by the activist movement. Their anti-development agendas are not revealed when campaigners turn up to support a local community group authentically concerned about contamination of their water supply as a result of longwall coal mining or coal seam gas drilling, for example. And I think that the picture is further complicated because, as Karl Ross has said, the world is defying the ability of existing structures and institutions to understand and arbitrate events effectively. Governments have less power than they once did. And the intrinsic deficit of governments is that they're required to turn something complex, reality, into something simple and comprehensible, like policy. The contract between people and government forces government to claim that it can understand and predict the massive complexity of the contemporary world and manage it on our behalf. Well, people increasingly don't believe government, and certainly not Australian government, and they are inexorably taking things into their own hands. The Edelman Trust Index states that only 20% of the general public believes that business leaders or government officials will tell the truth. Power is seeping out of nation states, multilateral institutions and corporates towards cities, towns, villages, clubs, religious groups and NGOs of every description. So who has influence, who is trusted, is radically changing. And Timothy Ash says that this is not a new world order, it's a new world disorder, an unstable kaleidoscope world, fractured, overheated, germinating future conflicts. And I think it's no coincidence because the explosion in the use of new digital and mobile social media platforms increasingly makes individuals and their networks far more important than rules and institutions. The Deloitte CEO report, Leading Through Connections, emphasises that this technology facilitates collaboration, relationships, and decentralised communications. And this newly connected economy and citizenry is replete with ambiguity. And NGOs have grabbed this territory. In fact, this technology, if you think about technology historically, it has always been developed by government and or business, and the community more broadly has been a slower adopter of that. In this instance, the community has adopted mobile technologies well before government and business. And so we're certainly in catch-up mode. Mr. McKibben, whom I referred to before, has said that in the internet age, you don't need direct mail and big headquarters, you need Twitter. So with a simple click, activists can create a buzz with the prospect that their campaigns will turn viral, and many do. Social media allows the creation and dissemination of urban myths about what the coal industry does and the impact of those activities. Such a medium facilitates fear-mongering, demonisation and distraction. It's an ideal means by which to propagate logical fallacies. In early 2012, it emerged in the Australian media that a coalition of activist groups led by Greenpeace had developed a prospectus for a five-year strategy to stop Australia's coal export industry. Their stated aim is to end public and political support for coal. A specific campaign fund of $6 million has been raised in a bid to make the industry unviable. It sets out to hijack local community groups, launch concerted legal attacks on projects and infrastructure, leverage concern around coal seam gas to tarnish coal mining, create investor uncertainty, drive up the cost of projects, train local citizens in civil disobedience and other campaign techniques, and develop emotive campaigns around the Great Barrier Reef in Queensland and health impacts in New South Wales. Their approach to leveraging genuine community concerns was revealed as positively Machiavellian. But my fundamental point is, when did Australians give Greenpeace and their fellow travellers veto rights over our economy? The anti-coal movement has suppressed alternative views by crowding them out. They attack coal's self-interest, undermining our credibility. Repeating falsehoods from numerous sources is common and effective. They appeal to a fictional consensus, suggesting that their perspective is legitimate and alternative views can and should be dismissed. And because the volume of chatter about the negative impacts of the industry has risen exponentially, along with the number of stunts and protests, people could be excused for believing that the coal industry is a culprit on a global scale. Now, it's only another minute or two. It's tough. Quantum and conviction count. The reaction to activism, aided by the connectivity of new technology, has been epidemic because nothing convinces, nothing propels action like conviction. Humans, indeed, according to the science, are biologically hardwired to mimic others outwardly. And in mimicking their outward displays, we come to adopt their inward states. Oscar Wilde once said that most of our lives are quotations from the lives of others. So the literature confirms that as humans, we are most influenced by what other people do. And the greater the number of people who do something, the more influenced we are. So to conclude, many anti-coal activists are deluding the public about their real agenda. For them, development is the problem, and environmental impacts are simply a manifestation of that problem. They're really saying that energy consumption must be radically cut. But that means accepting unfed mouths, uncured poverty, and subsistence existence. People in the developing world do not aspire to this. Neither, I think, do most Australians. It's time that we realise that a relative minority have amplified their voice disproportionately. Australians and the governments we elect, which take risks on our behalf that we are not always well placed to assess, need to open their eyes to what is going on and to clearly state that enough is enough. We need an informed debate about the full dimension of the challenges and solutions to the energy climate change conundrum. religious-like wars on the subject have to be rebutted. Distortion, mistruths, single-issue evangelism are diversions from developing realistic solutions to the energy climate change challenge. Simplism, dishonesty, acrimony have to cease. Nuance and civility must surely prevail. I think that the coal industry is indeed more sinned against than sinning. And there will be those who don't agree. But our challenge is to conceive of the national interest in pluralistic and embracing terms. The time for tunnel vision, my way or the highway, and planetary fundamentalism is at an end. Our environmental and economic challenges are just too important for the debate to continue in its current guise. It's time to make the case for burnable coal and curable poverty. Thank you.
Thanks to Nikki Williams. So now we've come to questions and discussion. We've got about 20 minutes. There are a lot of people here, but if everyone keeps their questions or comments brief and the responses are the same, we'll get through a lot. I can't see everyone here because of the lights, but we'll see how we go. So just briefly, your subtext was what's next. I mean, is anything next? I was on a debate with a professor 6 years ago who called for the end of the coal industry, but since then you've had the Rudd government. You've had the Gillard government for a while in cooperation with the Greens, and if the polls are right, you will have an Abbott government. They've all wanted to continue or want to continue substantial coal industry, and the Greens are still sitting on about 10% of the vote. So to what extent do you see there is a short-term or medium-term political problem? So if we just talk up the back and keep your comments.
I think the political problem is that politicians are responding to the vast the noise that is created and not differentiating between the legitimate problems or concerns that people have and politically motivated activism. And because they're not differentiating, they're responding, as governments always do, with regulation. It is no surprise to anyone who comes from the business sector when we talk about the burden of the regulatory impact, not just on our sector, but elsewhere. In the coal industry, 5 years ago in Queensland, a typical mining project might take 18 months from identification of resource to getting up. That's and cost about $100 million in capital expenditure up front. Today, that very same project takes nearly 5 years and costs $1 billion in upfront capital. Now, that's not entirely or exclusively to do with the burden of regulation, but the project delays and the regulatory burden, much of which is duplicative, has had an enormous and material impact on our sector. So in the short term, whether it's an Abbott government or whatever the future holds, there is a vast amount of regulation which needs to be pared back so that the right data is provided to government so that it can ensure that the right standards are being met by the industry. And that is not going to happen overnight.
Okay.
So it's still a big problem for us.
Okay, so Robin Williams.
Nikki, well spoken. Apart from those who are concerned about souls of fish and those who want to go back to live in the forest, are there no environmentally minded people willing to work with you to get some sort of decent future?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think it's a very important distinction because, of course, there are many NGOs full of very pragmatic, I mean, obviously concerned citizens who are pragmatic. They understand that you've actually got to have solutions. The solution is not the end of coal. The solution is what do we do with the coal that's being used? So yes, they do exist, but they're few and far between. And increasingly, I think, frustrated because our low emission technology future has been a lot slower, a lot harder, and a lot more expensive than any of us in the industry originally anticipated. And so there's a frustration that we haven't quite nailed that one yet. Lots of of things are happening in different places, but the sort of scalable solution is not in our immediate horizon. And nothing, no government that you talk to, and I was just in Europe last week and talking to the EU Energy Commissioner and you know, many other politicians, no one sees carbon capture and storage as being fundamentally on the ground till about 2030, which is much further away than we you know, than we would hope. So I'm not having a go at all concerned citizens, and I regard myself as pretty green, actually, which is why I'm wearing the green shoes, by the way. Yeah, so it's they are there, but they're few and far between, Robin.
There's a question here, yeah. Yes.
Last month there was a media owner talked about free enterprise, this regulation that you've been talking about, and so forth, and this tax. And he said that to defend those principles that you're talking about, you should be talking about them on the same grounds that the critics attack us on, which is fairness and justice, saying that, yes, is it fair for you to, is it fair for us to increase electricity prices for those who are poor on welfare, and so forth. So it comes to whether the argument has been too much on the economic front or solely on, and not attracting enough of the public because you haven't looked at the social side.
Okay. I think our industry has failed on lots of fronts in terms of how we have talked about our industry. You know, mining engineers are fascinated by heaps of black coal. They assume everybody else is. The fact that we haven't drawn a bridge adequately between what we do and what people value, and the role of what we do, the role that that plays not only in our own society but in the developing world, is certainly an omission by the industry. It's one that we are determined to redress. And I think that the Australian public has not been well served by politicians of any political persuasion, because the debate around the nexus between environmental policies, climate change policies, and our industry has been simplified. It's misled people. And we need a more energy-literate Australian population so that they can evaluate the pros and cons of any particular policy position or any particular fuel mix that our society might contemplate, and understand that these are not straightforward decisions. You can't say yes to this and no to that. We actually need a suite of solutions. We need a suite of technologies. We have issues like energy security to consider. We have an export industry. We have impacts on the people who live near our mines. We dislocate certain local communities. These are all genuine problems, not all of which are easily soluble. But I think what I can say is that the industry today is very focused on those sort of social problems, those other dimensions that you talked about, and it's incumbent upon us to try to work with our communities to come up with something that's reasonable for them.
Question then.
Could you comment on the latest coal-fired power plants, such as Germany's now installing, that capture particulate matter?
Question about the latest coal-fired power plants in Germany.
Okay. Many people you know, would be unaware or would be aware that Germany has the highest renewable penetration of any energy market. So around about 20%, I think, or 25% of their electricity mix is generated from renewables. What they don't know, however, is that Germany is building 11 new coal-fired power stations, and that, in fact, Germany is the fourth largest coal consumer in the world. The problem with coal combustion is that if it is if it's undertaken in an old and inefficient plant, there will be particulate matter, NOx, nitrous oxides, sulfur dioxide, and other things coming out of the flue gases, which are extremely unhelpful for the environment and for human health. So countries like Poland and throughout Eastern Europe are full of those very old power stations. What Germany is doing, however, is, of course, installing ultra-supercritical technologies, which have generating efficiencies of about 46%, which effectively takes out about 25% of their CO2 emissions in one hit without any special technology, just because they burn the coal more efficiently, and they capture those particulates and sulfur and nitrous oxide through technologies which are installed on the plant, things like flue gas desulfurization. So very important technologies. If we were able to replace the ancient fleet around the world with best of breed existing technology, we would make a huge immediate impact on the volume of CO2 emitted into the atmosphere from the burning of coal.
Simon. Question from a city-centric point of view. It would appear that politically the coal industry may well be coming up, at least hitting up against what appears to be a relatively new political competitor in the industry, in the form of the agricultural industry, particularly in Australia. Would you like to comment on how those two industries are going to actually get on in the world?
Look, it's something when I was at the New South Wales Minerals Council, and although it felt like a decade, Gerard, it was only 7 years. It was something that we were dealing with, particularly after action commenced in a new, or relatively undeveloped coalfield in the Gunnedah Basin, where you have very high worth farming on very good soils and that sort of thing, and the coal industry. So they definitely rubbed up together in not a very happy way. And it has led to an immense amount of time between the Farmers Association and the mining bodies to work out what are the appropriate sort of rules of engagement between the sectors? How do we collaborate? There's much that we do, and we have to remember that mining and farming have coexisted for more than 100 years in this country, largely without, without a major issue. But in certain parts of Australia, and particularly here in New South Wales, mining is taking place on top of, next to and underneath multiple alternative land uses. And that makes it a particularly tricky conundrum, not only for the farmers and communities and the mining industry, but for government, which needs to try to evaluate and balance the impacts and the benefits. It is not an insoluble problem. There is plenty of science which is now applied, particularly around water, which is a very sensitive area and of concern, and was deeply of concern during the drought that we experienced a couple of years ago. So I think that it comes down to science and agreement that if the science identifies that a certain process, whether it's mining or anything else, will be acceptable, and that whatever impacts it has can be managed, then I think that that's a result that we have to live with. And if the science says this would be an unacceptable impact, then that's something that our industry has to live with. But it's not as if our industry is against that. We actually probably have much more data than most governments and most regulators do because of the exploration work. So our understanding of hydrology, of the interaction between aquifers and all of these sort of dimensions is very advanced in many instances. So it is a question of community having trust in that data. And there we have a problem because as a proponent, if we say it, it must be a fib. And that's a very normal reaction by people to any proponent of any project. So there's more work to do. It is not insoluble, but it is definitely difficult.
Right, so we're getting to the end. Mr. Hand somewhere? Is it down here? And here. Okay, we'll go here and here. Okay, we'll start here. Yeah,
yes, very quick one. If you think carbon dioxide in the air is a problem, how much is the coal industry actually directly contributing to carbon sequestration
The coal industry is very active. You may not be aware that the Australian coal industry is the only coal industry in the world to have established a voluntary levy on itself to fund the development of low-emission technologies. That work is being done, or has been being done, in collaboration with both Commonwealth and state governments, and it's in projects which are not only in the coal sector, but also in the oil and gas sector, because sequestration is a key challenge for Australia. Finding the geology that is appropriate and safe to store CO2 and make sure that it's permanently harnessed is a challenge. It requires a lot of exploration work, and then it requires a lot of monitoring and scientific analysis. So our industry is involved with entities like the CSIRO in injecting CO2 in the Otway Basin, for example. We have launched a world first launch just last December in Queensland at the Callide Power Station, the world's first oxy-firing technology, which is, I won't bore you, but basically what it means is that you burn coal in oxygen rather than in air, and because you burn it in oxygen, it increases the concentration of CO2, which makes it much more economic to capture it from the flue gases. So there are 11 projects that we're involved in here in Australia. We're involved also in supporting, to the tune of $150 million, for example, in research organisations like the CSIRO and ANLEC R&D, who are actually looking at a vast array of low-emission technologies. So we've been active, unlike any other industry in the world.
Final question, Alan.
Yeah.
A quick one. We'd expect the Labor government, dependent on green votes, to not treat unethical and anti-social behaviour as a problem, as sort of describe the way which Greenpeace and company behave. It's a disappointing matter of record that the previous Conservative government itself did not take opportunities. I remember when Greenpeace climbed on the roof of John Howard's house, those people were not charged and convicted of trespass. There's also still a provision in our competition law which exempts environmental groups like Greenpeace from secondary boycotts. So, in fact, they have a legal right to pressure companies or pressure other companies. Surely it's time we did something about this.
I do agree. I think that, as far as I was talking about the rule of law, if the law says thou shalt not do X, Y, and Z, then it must be applied to individuals and organisations, whether they're corporates or NGOs, in equal measure. That's why it's there. We can't pick and choose it because we happen to approve of one cause and we don't approve of another. Legislative change that ensures accountability and transparency is in the interests of all Australians, and that's not just targeted at activist organisations, that would be targeted at trade unions or corporates or anybody else. So I think that's in all of our interests. But I would like to see a little consistency, and it does frustrate me enormously that people believe that they can act without consequence. It's one thing to take action, like Gandhi did. He took action, but he knew what the consequences were, and he did not resist those consequences. It's a very different very different approach from that which we see in Australia.
Nikki, many thanks.
Thanks to you.
I'll be very brief. There's a lot of pressing engagements we have. There's YBC wants to vox pop you. Sky wants to, the APEC channel wants to conclude. And I want to go away and contemplate the dignity of both fish and chips, which I'll be doing quite soon. But for now, it was a lively presentation from Dr. Williams. Thoughtful, be up on our podcast tomorrow, be published in time in the Sydney papers online. And thanks for your questions. We've had a lively discussion and provocative, and the speech will live on. So many thanks for coming along tonight. And thanks for our speaker. Well done. Well done, Nikki.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.